Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Thank everybody for coming tonight. This is the start of our 35th season here at the Poetry Center of Chicago. My name is Francesco Lovato, and I am the executive director. I'm really honored tonight to have two great poets reading tonight. They're multi-award winning. We have Avan Jordan and Tahima Jess. I'm going to do just a brief introduction on these two poets, talk a little bit about Poetry Center business, and then I'm going to bring the poets right up and have them read. After the reading, we're going to have a short Q&A with each of the poets. So start thinking about what they're saying in their work, and we've got some questions to start that off. Tahima Jess is a multi-award winning poet. He's won the Whiting Award, a literature fellowship from the National Endowments for the Arts, and his book Lead Belly won the National Poetry Series in 2004. And then Avan Jordan has also won a Whiting Award, and he's a recent recipient of the Guggenheim Fellowship. And so I'd like to bring Tamba up first, and so if you give him a welcome.
What's up, Chi-Town?
What's up?
All right. It's really good to be here. And, kind of loud, I guess. Is this thing ringing? It isn't? Okay. Well, I just want to say it's really great to be here. Thanks to the Poetry Center for bringing me out here and hooking me up with my main man, Mr. Van Jordan in the house. And thank you for coming out on a very blustery day. So I'm just going to hit some poems. I'm going to do one new, and then I'm going to do the rest from this book, Lead Belly. And this first one is about the city that I grew up in. This is about Detroit, the city I left, the city I fled, the place I was born and reveled in until I was 18, and how sharp it was, dripping with the names of cars littering its body. El Dorado, El Camino, Deuce and a Quarter, Caprice. Caddy and Corvette, Mustang, GMC, and comeback K-car, the glitter of the chrome and the spit shine of streetlight on the body. How my father must have loved the burnished and flattened steel of its name. How its Motown voice got stuttered, rasped, chewed, till swallowed in the 67 ashes. How the reel of a Joe Louis fist punched its way through the nationhood, a perfect black fist piercing its way through the blonde of America. A rebar uppercut, a steel jab, and as we know, all that metal must succumb to the brown reclamation of rust. This is about leaving the place you were weaned. The 7 mile road and the broken pavement, the engine of black pride that backfired like a pistol shot in the middle of the night in the neighbor's yard as the sky burnt its way circling into your ears. This is about the Young Boys Incorporated, crack entrepreneurs of the 80s, skull caps twisted like question marks to the stratosphere of smog, the Renaissance center, a giant cylinder of glint stabbed in the center of a busted heart. Detroit and Deliverance both detail my departure, the way I said I would never come back, the way out was any place but there. When I come back sometimes to visit, when I drive down the streets and feel the hair trigger pulse in the streets, I know this is about a father's arrival and a son's departure. This is about all South Carolina ever wanted and all South Carolina's progeny ever wanted to walk away from. To turn your back on the place you grew up in is indeed a sin. A reek of shame and a smack of cowardice. Call me deserter. Call me departed. Call me desperate. Call me deluded. Call me anything but home. God bless the home of funk. The Technicolor Kool-Aid alligator shoes. The sandpaper smooth voices of Motown and the sweat of every factory that boiled down the city to its rendered bone. God bless the Arab stores and the splattered blood of the Brewster Projects. God bless the whores of Woodward Avenue, the children so beautiful and scattered and flocked between brick and tar. God bless the architecture of ruin in each pitted porch step. God bless the policeman's bullet and the ever so angled pork pie brim. God, like a three-piece suit and a diamond earring, like the primed pumped action shotgun kept beneath my mother's bed. God, like one streetlight for three city blocks. God, like the first payment on a brand new second mortgage. God, abandoned and stripped down to the axles off a side street alley. The many gods of Motor City rising from the smoke of Devil's Night fires. When you come for me, all I ask is time to check myself for tremor. Latch down the pimp strut you taught me behind my mother's back. Time to stare straight into your chrome-plated grill without a blink at my reflection, growing larger with every rotation of the wheel. So this rest of these poems are going to be from the book Lead Belly, which is about the life of Hughie Ledbetter, who was a musician born in the mid-1880s in the southeast part of the country, and died in 1949 in Harlem, New York. This one, and the poems are in the perspective of various people and objects around Lead Belly at the time. So this is the first poem in the book called Lead Belly's Lessons. Mr. Haney owned Shreveport's General Store, where a dollar a week brought my 12-year-old frames lift and lunge of barrel and crate across a sawdust floor. Still, he wanted more. See, the guitar refused to get naked with Haney. He would fumble up the seams of its hidden croon, hook, clasp, and bodice of each tune mangled down to a stunted strum. So he'd quit. He'd hoist bourbon and order me to hoist song. The velvet locomotive of Merrill D. Palm I tote up from the swollen center of guitar. Its catch and slide caught between palms and cradled across Louisiana starlight. His bottle and scowl grew louder with each reel and jump that I played while getting paid to show the way of undressing music from its wooden seams. But it was like coaxing stone to bathe in sky. He never let his flesh wallow in the blue floating round his earth. So he buried himself deeper in his own dirt. He'd think on the hurt a white man can do without second thought. He'd slur, "Nigga, someday I'm gonna kill you," and stagger home. It was there, alone, in the dark darkness of me, that I first learned the ways of pure white envy. And thank you, Mr. Haney, for teaching me. This next poem is in the voice of of his longtime lover, who was not very tall and had a really built body. She was stacked. Her name was Stella, and she was his guitar. Mistress Stella speaks. "You think I'm his property, 'cause he paid cash to grab me by the neck, swing me across his knee, and stroke the living song from my hips. You think he is master of all my 12 tongues, spreading notes thick as a starless night, strangling spine till my voice is a jungle of chords. The truth is that I owned him. Since the word love first blessed his lips, since hurt and flight and free carved their way into the cotton-fused bones of his fretting hand, since he learned how pleading men hunt for my face in the well of their throats till their tongues are soaked with want. Yes, Each day he comes back home from the fields, from Chang'an Fury, from the smell of sometime women who borrow his body. He bends his weight around me like a wilting weed, drinking in my kiss of fretboard across fingertip till he can stand up straight again, aching from what he left behind, rising sure as dawn.
This next poem is in the voice of a guy that he used to hang out with, a guy named Blind Lemon Jefferson. Anybody know Blind Lemon? Blind Lemon fans in the house? All right. So in researching his story, came across this, the fact that they used to hang out together. And I also came across the fact that Blind Lemon actually held the occupation that he mentions in this poem, 1912, Blind Lemon Jefferson explaining to Leadbelly.
And everything gotta be live on you, son. Read the crowd like a fortune teller's tea leaf. From the plunk of a nickel to the bang of a quarter to the smell of thieves scheming on a blind man's cash. You see this scar? I was between guitars in San Antonio and broke enough to wrestle men for carnival money. The one that did this had come back three times for an ass whooping only a fool could want again. But when he pulled that shiv out of his boot, didn't nobody say nothing. Had they bets on how hard I was gonna bleed. That's what the world is, son. Desperate enough to pin a blind man's back to the ground for all the money he can't never even see. Hungry enough to chop him down for taking what he's earned. That's what the world is. They lost money that day. And I squeezed my Stella out the pawnbroker's grip one last time. That's what that box of strings is, son. Your boxcar ticket out of nowhere. Maybe even steak dinner, silk ties, and all the leg you can stroke. But you got to wrestle for it, son. You got to.
And here we have... I guess we should hear from Leadbelly a little bit, huh? How about that? Two poems from prison. The first time Leadbelly went to prison, he went to prison for shooting a man over a woman. The second time he went to prison, it was for stabbing a man over a song. So the second time he went to prison, he went to Angola prison. Leadbelly in Angola prison, down again.
This place sucks men firmly in her mouth, swallows them whole and leaves them shrunken masses of muscle, melts them down in a cast iron gut and shits them out with new names. Smiling Johnny Lee is now Dick Licker. James Baker became Ironhead. Joe Sims makes himself Rat, and Roy from Brazos County was beaten into tight eye. They put me in the belly of a place with a name that lifts your tongue to the roof of your mouth with promise and presses back down, tells you to go. Just as your lips beg the kiss of surprise and oh, that grabs liver and squeezes bowels shut. Law pushes the dirt of truth beneath myth's fertile topsoil. Someone said, this place has a faraway sound. Sounds like the songs we sung before the church and Jesus lashed us down to this moaner's bench of religion. I say, don't nothing sound more American than Angola.
The second song, poem is based off of a song that I know I used to sing in grade school. Little ditty, and he used to sing when he was doing his work. It was a work song. When he was trying to get good time, good behavior time, when he was in Angola prison. Leadbelly sings to his number one crew.
Gonna jump down, spin around, pick a bell of cotton. Gonna jump down, spin around, pick a bell of day. Oh, Lordy, pick a bell of cotton.
Oh, Lordy, pick up a little day. Gonna jump down, spin around, pick up a little con. Jump down, spin around, pick up a little day. Oh, Lordy, pick up a little con. Oh, Lordy, 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 Lordy. Gotta jump down, jump, gotta jump up to go down in the bottom land. A brown bird of sweat strapped to a sack of feathered stone. Gotta tumble down to the basement of hell after I done lifted up to heaven and the steel-toed angels kick me back under the sun's bright red sickle, dripping with dawn, spinning in a sky so dizzy with heat till it spills its weight on my back, wraps its blistered arms round my neck, pulls down till I pick 500 pounds of dirty cloud from prisoned up farm. I mean, 1 ton a week. I mean 52 tons a year. I mean bail after bail after bail after bail, cause it ain't no bail. I mean, what could I make if I had bail and all the bails I ever picked? 10,000 handkerchiefs to dry my mama's tears. 20 years of double-breasted suits to glide home in every day. A new tie for every time I strut through a feel-good woman's smile. A fresh tablecloth for every homemade meal I missed. And if I took a scrap, if I took a scrap from every denim and linen and dyed piece of cloth that got spun from them bells, could I patchwork a shroud wide enough, heavy enough, bright enough, dark enough, mended and torn and mended enough to lay this place to rest? And what if I set that shroud on fire? Gonna jump down, spin around, pick a bell a day. Gonna, got to, can't say no, can't work away. Got to jump in, jump for the sun, jump against sky, jump across pain, jump up when I'm beat down by the riverside, when my sword and shield is my song, and my word and my breath, and my mama spun me round and slapped me down when I lied and stole. And if only I'd have listened to my mama, I wouldn't be in the shape I'm in. Hanging round the whiskey still and drunk on gin is what I picked, is what got me here, picking my way through this hand to stock, to bowl, to bag, to hand, to stock, to bowl, to bag. To reach the twist, to pluck the stuff, to reach the twist, to pluck the stuff. A blizzard of casket-sized bales, heavy enough to outweigh me and all I've ever owned, big enough to coffin up the boy I was before a pistol flash made me man. That schoolboy smothering in the soft strangle of cotton that I heave up from soil every day. Oh Lordy, oh Lordy, oh Lordy, oh Lordy, oh Lordy, oh Lordy, pick a bell of cotton. Oh Lordy, oh Lordy, oh Lordy, pick a bell a day. Oh Lordy, oh Lordy, Jesus, God, did you ever carry a cotton sack? I mean, did you ever feel the bud in the palm of your hand? I mean, did you ever lift a bale like you lifted that cross, Jesus? And did it weigh as much as a cotton field, Jesus? And when you show me the holes in your hands and feet, Jesus, can I show you the blisters in my hands and feet? And can we size up the lashes on our backs? And when you fell in the sun, in the dust, in the thorns, did they wipe your face? And did they look at the cloth and see my face scorched in the cotton of their cloth? And was my mouth wide open, my eyes squinted up from singing this song every, oh Lordy, every, oh Lordy, every.
Thank you. I think I'm about at my time. Okay. All right. I'll do another one. I think one thing that was very important is I think there were a lot of parallels between African Americans and the prison industrial complex, the music industry, etc. But the most hopeful thing I think I found from this story was the love story. And this last poem is from the perspective of Martha Promise, who was 17 years younger than Led, and got together with him after his second bid in prison. So she was hooking up with a two-time ex-con with no immediate job prospects. I had no idea what was on her mind, but I figured I'd give it a shot. This is Martha Promise, receives Lead Belly, 1935. When your man comes home from prison, when he comes back like the wound and you are the stitch,
when he comes back with pennies in his pocket and prayer fresh on his lips, you got to wash him down first. You got to have the wild weed and tree bark boiled and calmed, waiting for his skin like a shining baptism back into what he was before gun barrels and bars chewed their claim in his hide and spit him stumbling backwards into screaming sunlight. He got to scrub loose the jail time finger smears from ashy skin, lather down the cuff marks from ankle and wrist, rinse solitary stench loose from his hair, scrape curse and confession from the welted and the smooth, the hard and the soft, the furrowed and the lax. He got to hold tight that Shadrach's face between your palms. Take crease and lid and lip and brow and rinse slow with river water. And when he opens his eyes, you tell him, calm and sure, how a woman birthed him back whole again. Thank you.
Okay, before we bring Ava and Jordan up, I want to make a couple announcements about some of our upcoming readings, and also to thank Can TV, who's in the back filming this. On November 7th, we have a reading called Fightin' Words, and that's featuring Brian Turner and Bruce Weigel. Brian Turner is recently returned from the Iraq War. He won the Beatrice Hawley Award. Bruce Weigel is a writer who has been writing war-related poetry since the 60s. We're going to combine them with a professor who specializes in Vietnam-era history to lead a dialogue, essentially, about them, the war, how it affects them. So don't miss that one. And then we're partnering with Next Book on November 13th, and that's going to be the Hebrew poetry of Muslim and Christian Spain, and that's going to be a really interesting reading as well. So next up, I want to bring Ava and Jordan up, whose book is also in the back. We have two. We have Rise, and we have his newest one, Quantum Lyrics. Let's welcome Ava and Jordan.
Thank you. I want to say thanks also to the Poetry Center for bringing me out here today, and for you all for coming out in this beautiful space, but on a not-so-beautiful night. It's just an honor to read with Tayemba. It was good to hear your words. And you know, I love Leadbelly and taught the book, but it was just good hearing the reading of them. I want to start off with a new poem. This is called A Song Composed from Forgetting. I'm trying to make music from the sound I hear outside my window, a siren coming and bleeding away, a girl's voice just beneath it, notes my flesh would somehow claim as music. But I keep trying to make something else, something, if possible, less discordant than its chords of realities. With my own name in memory, a changing key depending on the day, my body mutes through the change in light, the change in time, struggling to collect the past and to make sense of a moment years before this one. And I swear it happened like this. It was in front of a people's drugstore, a couple fighting, if you could call her part in it all, fighting. He had her by her hair with one hand, and he punched her with his free hand. Her blood. I remember this most. And his face looking at me as if he would offer her to me when he was done. And once I stepped in to stop the scene mid-action, they both stopped and turned on me. The woman grew fists and threw them at me, as if I had entered their bedroom in the middle of some other act of love. For all I know, this memory belongs to another, not only me, but also my mother or father, possibly them fighting in a dream. Today, though, a girl's voice shatters outside beneath a siren. And it sounds too familiar, too much like a bell ringing for years in my head, too much like too many neighborhoods in which I've lived my life. Voices falling not like leaves to the ground, but like glass from this window, breaking with my gaze through it, with the lives I see as I refuse to get involved, turning up the music to dull my own hand as it fingers notes through her dirge for help. The book Magnolia, which isn't here tonight, but is a the book I spent most the past few years with, is about the life of Magnolia Cox, who was the first African American to win the national, well, to get to the final round of the National Spelling Bee in 1936. And she was cheated out of the win. And she has a pretty tragic story of this loss changing the course of her life. She was a genius, had an IQ of a genius, memorized 100,000 words, straight A student. But then a few years later dropped out of school and became a domestic in the home of a doctor. And she later married a guy named John Montier who was a bit more streetwise than her. And this is from the portion of the book that deals with her adult life. This is the night she spent with the man that would become her husband later, John Montier. And it's written in the form of a dictionary definition. The poems in the book, while I was writing them, I was spending a lot of time with the dictionary going through spelling bee words. And as I was going through the Oxford English Dictionary, I would come across prepositions and conjunctions and articles. And, you know, unlike the spelling bee words, which had very succinct definitions, these words had 4 and 5 pages of definitions. And I would ask myself, like, do I really know the definition to and from and if? This is 9 definitions of the word from. Preposition, 1. Starting at a particular place or time. As in, John was from Chicago, but he played guitar straight from the Delta. He wore a blue suit from Robert Hall's. His hair smelt like coconut. His breath like mint and bourbon. His hands felt like they were from slave times when he touched me. Hungry, stealthy, trembling. 2. Out of. He pulled an out of bills from his pocket, paid the man, and we went upstairs. 3. Not near to or in contact with. He smoked the weed, but surprisingly, he kept it from me. He said it would make me too self-conscious, and he wanted those feelings as far away from us as possible. He said a good part of my beauty was that I wasn't conscious of my beauty. Isn't that funny? So we drank Bloody Mothers, Hennessy and tomato juice, which was hard to keep from him. He always did like to drink. 4. Out of the control or authority of. I was released from my mama's house, from dreams of hands holding me down, from the threat of hands not pulling me up, from the man that knew me but of whom I did not know, released from the dimming of twilight, from the brightness of morning, from the love I thought had to look like love, from the love I thought had to taste like love, from the love I thought I had to love like love. 5. Out of the totality of. I came from a family full of women. I came from a family full of believers. I came from a pack of witches. I'm just waiting to conjure my powers. I came from a legacy of lovers. I'm just waiting to seduce my seducer. I came from a pride of proud women, and we take good care of our young. 6. As being other or another than. He couldn't tell me from his mother. He couldn't tell me from his sister. He couldn't tell me from the last woman he had before me, and why should he? We're all the same woman. 7. With some person, place, or thing as the instrument, maker, or source. Here's a note from my mother, and you can take it as advice from me. A weak lover is more dangerous than a strong enemy. If you're going to love someone, make sure you know where they're coming from. 8. Because of. Becoming an alcoholic, learning to walk away, being a good speller, being good in bed, falling in love. They all come from practice. 9. Outside or beyond the possibility of. In the room, he kept me from leaving by keeping me curious. He kept me from drowning by holding my breath in his mouth. Yes, he kept me from leaving till the next day when he said, "Leave!" Then he couldn't keep me from coming back. This next poem is in the voice of Magnolia's mom, watching her jump rope, double Dutch style, two girls and two ropes. This is simply called rope. As if two girls were stirring a fire on all sides of my daughter, she is set ablaze. The girls swing two clotheslines between them as if they were goddesses holding two country roads leading to each other. Neighbors surround her syncopated dance as her seizure of heat begins to flicker on the moonlit sidewalk. Now the ropes are white hot. Her hair ignites in the upswing. Her barrettes like petrified butterflies click on the offbeat. Her knees pump like she's walking on red coals. Her arms flail as if she's calling the rain to put her out. She jumps. She flirts with the flame. She jumps backwards and then turns forward, rocking in and out of the light. Her hands testify around her head or pose on yet-to-be hips till her fire snuffs out as a wind blows cold. A car with flashing lights slows past, and the braids of our summer night surrender to gravity. There's time markers in the book. The book spans the time between 1936 to 1980. And various figures appear, Josephine Baker, Asa Philip Randolph, Jesse Owens. When we get to the 70s, the person I choose to represent that time period is Richard Pryor. And Richard Pryor had a, I don't know how many people remember this alter ego Mudbone, but this is really how Richard Pryor found his voice as a comedian. And this is a true story from his life. This epigraph is from the Book of the Samurai. It is spiritless to think you cannot attain to that which you've seen and heard the masters attain. The masters are men, you're also a man. This is the night Richard Pryor met Mudbone. The moon hung orange as any sun just before it faces evening, like a flaming breast in the sky calling my name. And I walked out under it and rubbed the moonlight all over my face and hands the way the old folks used to do with sunlight on Wednesdays, because back in those times, the hard times, harder than any of this shit we're faced with today, they said the only time the sun came out was on Wednesdays if you were lucky, and a boy had to get his ass up early just to catch that. Well, it was a day like that that I'm about to tell you about, a day when all I could see were the mismatched symbols on the slot machine of my life. Surprisingly, this isn't a story about a woman. All my relationships with women were one long-leg story in high heels, but I'm not even trying to get to sex here for once. What I'm trying to say is when your foot brushes a woman's toes under the sheets, when you feel her breath on the back of your neck, turning your spine into a tall building, when your eyes meet hers while making love, you know you're looking at the truth. The truth is what I found whenever I thought life could prove better than the craps game I was born into. Although it's always just a roll of the dice, like that time in Vegas when I walked out on stage, half high, half drunk, in 68, and there sat Dean Martin in the front row, drinking one hand and a half-burned-out cigarette in his other cufflinked hand. And I looked at his seal-hide hair and his wax figure of a face, and the rest of the audience went out of focus. All the voices were put on mute. All I could hear was Dino stirring the ice in his drink, and I asked myself, what the fuck am I doing here? My skinny black ass from Peoria, Illinois. I walked out on stage and a switch flipped off inside my head. The room went white. My agent told me, like in the movies, man, told me on the phone real chill like, he said, I'd never work in this life again. But then I realized it wasn't neon marquees, gangsters, or headline acts I was afraid of. It was me. I spent years imitating Bill Cosby, telling jokes that fit me like a suit two sizes too big. I struck a sad figure on stage even when I was good. Don Rickles came up to me once and said, what a great show. It's amazing how much you sound like Cosby. And then I wondered if everyone else could tell I had climbed inside his skin and zipped him up. I wondered who else would unzip my monologue and find me there trembling. After Vegas, I headed to New York and got to open for Miles at the Village Gate. And Miles looked through me, just like Rickles had, but he did something that was as beautiful as his music. Miles knew I was looking for a way to fall off the planet's edge, getting high and wanting more. So one night, as I sat drinking in my dressing room, the MC comes in right before curtain and tells me Miles changed the lineup. I thought I was fired, man, but Miles decided that he was going to open for me. Do you know what a bad motherfucker you gotta be to have Miles Davis open for you? That's like God, Jack. So I go out on stage, and as I'm about to go into my best Bill Cosby impression, I see this old man with cold-colored skin sitting on the edge of the stage. He's looking at me like, well, boy, Let's see what you got. And I don't want to hear none of that Bill Cosby shit either. And he said, tell them about Badass Oilwell, about the wino, or about Miss Rudolph the hoodoo lady, how she had one titty that had an eye tattooed on it, and another that had a mouth, and how when that one titty blew a kiss and the other winked, you knew for the first time you had smoked enough of that shit. I asked the old man his name, and he said, they call me Mudbone. I was born in Tupelo, Mississippi. I looked at him sideways, and he said, it's a city, boy. I was born there a long time ago. So long ago ain't worth remembering when exactly, because after a certain while, it's just a long time ago. Like me, I could tell he died many times and had some stories to tell. You don't live this long being a fool. There's a whole lot of wise young men deader than a motherfucker, he said. Yes, I thought, my meditations on death keep me alive, too. Death would show up from time to time like a distant relative who thought I had been away too long. The funny thing is, I spent years searching, laughing on the tip of a needle, crying between a woman's legs, imitating other people's work, just to come back to a man who had been there all along saying, hey, look over here at me. But I had ignored him, thinking he didn't have anything to say. So I stood there with a cigarette throbbing in one hand and a microphone rocking in the other, and I told them about the fallen angels of my life. And I grabbed a handful of the glow from the spotlights, rubbed it all over my body, right on stage, naked, in front of everybody. And I smiled, and they smiled back, as the light growing brighter now from the rafters turned to sunshine. I'll read a couple of poems from Rise. This takes its title from a church in San Francisco that took John Coltrane as its patron saint. The Alice that's mentioned in here, of course, is Alice Coltrane, great pianist, organist, harpist, arranger, composer, and wife of Coltrane. St. John Coltrane African Orthodox Church. Maybe it was the practice of practice, he and Alice in the grocery store, and him fingering keys up and down the aisles, the magic of capturing spirit in a whole note, in a mouthpiece, in Alabama, like light bent through a prism into color. Maybe they figured out his distant relationship to Lazarus in 56, pushing the stone from in front of his open bell, bouncing sound off the east to the west. It was intangible, the way he raised a soul to intaglio, like a gospel hymn raises tongues to tones understood only by the secret society of the saxophone. Alice knew the secrets of the stars and the notes in between, the power of laying hands on scales, and the baptism into the void between chords and back to bring forth what had not been before Train. It's no surprise to see the church with his face stained in the glass. No questions surround the choir of saxophones, the congregation's many shades of sound. Not the skin, but the sound, not the verse, but the riff, not the jazz, but the spirit. How is this any different from heroin turning a man's soul? If Jesus can turn water into wine, then a junkie can resurrect as a saint. Maybe you've not come to the altar with succubus from Satan up and down your arms, taken the fellowship wherever you could find it, blown blood through a horn, shut up with the devil, and felt him ejaculating your veins. When man is at his weakest, faith has a perfect pitch. This next poem, Miles Davis appears, and there's a reference to Time After Time. This is the cover of the Sidney Lauper tune. This is called Kinda Blue. How I tried to explain the love I heard between the notes. How I reached for you when he played. How when a man's heart splits open in the middle of a song, whether playing or just connecting, it is not unlike a gasp for air at the close of sex. At that moment, how wondrous our faces seem when we hear a soul speak through a horn. How perfect the grammar between the notes. And it was not because I knew I would leave you years later in D.C. once I found you in bed with another man that I took you downtown to see Miles Davis in concert at Cincinnati's Music Hall. It was just because you could leave me. And I knew even then when I knew nothing, when I had just bought my first Miles Davis album, I knew that good memories haunt us as much as the bad ones. And that night in 85, I think it was because I loved him that you hated Miles Davis. Oh, you wore that short skirt, your legs pouring out like two high C's from a trumpet's bell, but you still had an attitude. You said he was a heroin addict, a junkie, that his skin stretched like leather because of drugs. And I was reminded of my neighbor who was on crack, and the night he came to beg for some money, this guy who had a wife and two kids. I asked him why he got high as if it were my business. With his head turned from me, he said, Man, it's like you having sex and you come and just keep coming and coming 15, 20 minutes straight. Then he looked at me and asked, have you ever known love like that? I gave him $5 that night. And despite your rolling eyes and the you made with your teeth, I bought you a ticket to the concert. Remember how we sat on the front row and how in the middle of the first set, Miles walked across the stage on that tightrope invisible to all but him? How he stopped at his edge and how he played time after time and broke it down to you and stared first at your legs and then straight into your eyes. I wasn't jealous, you see, because he made my point for me. And to this day, because of that night, I know for certain that you still love one of us. And look at you now, years later, getting high in your apartment, your stereo spinning a Miles Davis disc. You no longer question what kind of blue pulls a man's skin so tightly over the face. Yes, what do the uninitiated who can only listen know about this kind of love? I'm going to move to quantum lyrics. I'll transition with the quantum lyrics with another Miles Davis poem. I took a sculpting class a few years ago and have been playing around with it and obsessed with it ever since. I'm not any good at it, but I still love it. And my first project was trying to do a face of Miles Davis. This is called Sculpting the Head of Miles Davis. Secure the base so the flesh will have something to cling to. Wrap wire around the wood and fill with clay, liberally. No, continue to add clay more than it seems you will ever need for his indented cheeks, and slap more onto the base of the skull. Don't forget the constellation of bones in the skull. Don't get hypnotized by the geometry of the eyes. Gouge your fingers into his sockets. We'll deal with this later. Pull back and follow the rhythm of the jawline. Rub your thumb over the forehead. Stab your fingers into his cheekbones. Raise them higher. Doesn't his face cast ribbons of shadow? Doesn't he have cavernous dimples? But don't make him smile. Imagine the teeth are behind the sheet music of his lips. Imagine the tongue is aflame behind the teeth. Imagine there's a voice scratching in the throat. No, the temples sit too high. The nose will not bespeak his middle class air. Raise the forehead, straighten the nose bridge, deepen the furrow of his brow. Now, remember the look in his eye back in 89 when you saw him play at the Beacon Theater? Can you see it yet? Stand back. Tell me if the man whose face you hold in your palms could watch his mute drop from his horn at the start of his solo, pick it up, no lowering of his head, no shrugging of his shoulders, and go on to blow a phrase that still trembles between your fingers. One of the things I'm exploring in quantum lyrics is male vulnerability, and I'm using physics as a theme throughout the book. This poem's in the voice of Einstein, the physicist Richard Feynman, and also DC Comics superheroes. And one of the ones I'm using is the Flash, who can run at the speed of light. So this is from DC Comics, November 1990, number 44. Never look back, Flash. Your life might be gaining on you. And this is called The Flash Reverses Time. When I'm running across the city on the crowded streets to home, when, in a blur, the grass turns brown beneath my feet, the asphalt steams under every step, and the maple leaves sway on the branches in my wake, and the people look in that bewildered way in my direction, I imagine walking slowly into my past, among them, at a pace at which we can look one another in the eye and begin to make changes in the future from our memories of the past. The bottom of a bottomless well, you may think, but why not dream a little? Our past doesn't contradict our future. They're swatches of the same fabric stretching across our minds, one image sewn into another, like the relationship between a foot and a boot, covariant in space and time. One moves along with the other, like an actor in a shadow play, like a streak of scarlet light across the skyline of your city, sweeping the debris, which is simply confetti, candy wrappers, a can of soda, all the experience of a day discarded and now picked up, even down to the youthful screams of play that put smiles on the faces of the adults who hear remnants of their own voices through a doorway leading back to a sunrise they faintly remember. Another character for DC Comics is the Atom, who has the power to shrink his body down to the particle level. There's a new Adam written by a great comic book writer, Gail Simone, who is now, if anyone cares about this stuff, one of the first women to write. She's doing a new series on Wonder Woman, and which is a big deal because it's been written by men for many years. So this is from DC Comics, June, July, 1962, Adam number one, Master of the Plant World. This is simply called the Adam. It was as if no one had seen me until I mastered the science of shrinking my body down to a particle level, a basic element of life so pure that it was above all frequencies of critique. It was as if no one felt my hand till it was pure vibration, lighter than a gnat's wing on the back of their hand. Not till my touch became a thought experiment of memory, people wondering if they could recall my skin against theirs and if this recollection was just that or a new experience, something impossible yet flesh and bone. I'm stronger than most men, but I'm as weak as any man, too. I fight to save the world from destruction, but I also fight to hear my lover, Jean Loring, say yes to marriage and to figure out my purpose in this world. Do you think if I could have managed my life at 6 feet and 180 pounds, I would have shrunk to near invisibility just to be seen? Sometimes shrinking to the size of a coin is a superpower. Sometimes it's just a way to find value in one's life. While I was writing this book, my father died. And so the back end of the book is filled with elegies to my dad. And this poem takes the title from the classic Thomas Kuhn book, science book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. I placed the trombone back on its stand after attempting Summertime in C major. Childhood memories of band camp and lessons streamed to my embouchure, hands and gut. After the ringing in my head has passed and a note settled, it seems at my feet. I linger on a photograph of my family, my parents, brothers, and nephew. I suppose I stare off into it longer than I mean to, thinking of my father, dead 8 months now. The color image blurs a bit on this print, not recalling his smile as I recall it in memory. And also, the camera didn't know this would be his last photo. So the occasion was captured with people moving like apparitions in the background, more than the spirit of the man in the midst of it all. Even with digital cameras, there's still a pointillist dotting flesh on the faces of my family. I shake my head to clear the trance and turn on the television. First, news of a woman raped. The pundits keep the stress on alleged. I think of all the women who are watching TV now. I turn the channel to a rerun of CSI. All this technology, yet we still can't prove rape. What's the use of suspending disbelief? I turn the TV off and sit back down to the horn, but still next to the photo. This time I notice my father's hand at rest on my nephew's shoulder. My nephew might be practicing his cello as I sit in front of this brass, which turns to folk art in my hands. I don't really play anymore, you know. I once thought music would be my life, and it's simply too easy to try to play and say, that's enough. Too easy to say, at least my nephew plays strings. Nothing changes that easily. It's in the way the mouthpiece refuses to kiss me back, how the ceiling fan whirs in the room, yet humidity hangs in the air. A need builds in me, only after struggle builds around me. A mythical ether challenging this horn with its song stuck in its throat, memory, the present moment, and all the notes falling between them, struggling to get out. Two more poems. I don't know if this is still a big deal to young people, but when I was a kid, we used to have house parties with this black light bulb from Spencer's Gifts or party stores. And we used to make your teeth and your eyes and nails glow. So this is called Black Light. Our bodies cast a shadow of one body under a black bulb pulse in your mother's basement. Light, even when it's black, moves faster than youth or old age. It's the constant in our lives. But I remember when I thought your house, always ready for a party, even during the week, was the fastest element in my life. Toenails, lint, teeth, eyes, everything was holy under the glow. I suspect even my bones radiated when we danced, which was always more of a grind than a dance. Whether the song sung came from Rick James or Barry White. We call what we did in the coat room dancing too. My hands ultraviolet under your dress, but innocent. We were only kids after all. I was 16 and you were a woman of 18. Already we knew how to answer each other without asking questions, how to satisfy by seeing what nearly satisfied looked like in each other's face. This all before I ran out to sneak back into my mother's house in the middle of the night. But now, it's 8 years later, you're walking, it seems, so I offer you a ride. And you look in and smile, and when I see you, I wonder what would have happened if we had stayed in touch. I have to get back to work the next morning in D.C., a 5-hour drive. It's near dark, and I want to get on the road before night falls completely, but I stop anyway. It's been too many years, and I mistake your gesture. Then I realize you don't really recognize me until you back away and turn on your heel. Then a man with a jerry curl and a suit that looks like it's woven from fluorescent lighting walks up and looks at me like I wasn't born in this town. And for the first time in my life, I question it myself. He walks up as slow and sure as any old player should on Sunday night. While walking away, you two exchange words. You don't look back. But we see each other in our heads, aglow, half naked, under our black bulb pulse in your mother's basement, given a diadem by the lucid night and the street lamp's torch. The man wearing the fluorescent suit casts a broad shadow like a spotlight into which you step. Maybe he's the reason we're here tonight beneath these dim stars, casting a light true enough, finally, for us after all these years to see each other. This is the last poem. I just want to say thanks again to the Poetry Center for the opportunity to be here and to read with Tamba. It's been a real pleasure. This is called R&B, another elegy. There's a reference to C. Dolores Tucker, who became famous in the 90s for, despite all of her lifetime of civil rights work, she became famous in the 90s for working against misogyny and violence in rap lyrics. And the reason we have explicit lyrics now on labels on rap music, R&B. Listen long enough to the radio and you'll think, maybe C. Dolores Tucker was right. While the hip world is falling in love with rappers with marquee quality prison records, I'm falling deeper under the spell of singers who can still play piano. I never needed my female vocalists to look good in a thong to feel their voices in my bones. I never needed the male crooners to carry guns to know they'd kill for love. I said this the other night, driving through Akron, Ohio, a week after my father's funeral, trying to find a station without gangster rap or smooth jazz. For years, I watched my father die, and when the day came, my father had already predicted the Chicago White Sox would win it all this year. And on the TV in his hospice care room, as he took his last breath, Jermaine Dye hit the first home run of the series. This is all over now. November. Trees on front lawns rustle, and globes on street lamps rattle in a determined wind. I'm looking for fast food and some music to change my mood, and the weather. In these silent moments, I listen open to any sign or savior I can find. I pass a half-lit neon Arby's roast beef sign, struggling through a dark night of orbiting debris. I can barely tell whether they're open or closed, so I take a chance, turn around, and fall into its orbit as well. I walk in and I see two young black men, young brothers to me, with cornrows in their hair, and each carrying about 50 pounds more than they should on their young bones, standing behind the counter. One brother asks me if he can take my order, but I can't think about roast beef. I think, why is he so overweight as a teenager? I think, what is he going to look like when he's 40, my age? I think, what is he going to look like if he makes it to 77, my father's age, when he died? I shake my head and tell him I'm not ready. I try to focus on food. I'm having a hard time because the music is so loud, some alternative rock with an emo boy voice. Once I order, the brother who took my order starts to argue with the one making my sandwich. And when I think the argument is getting too loud, when I think they're going to come to blows, they burst into laughter and they stop and they look at me and then they look at each other. The brother on the grill nods to the brother at the register, who then, with great earnestness, makes a request to me. Sir, could you please tell him that that's not Al Green? I say, of course that's not Al Green. Then the brother on the sandwich says, nah, not what's playing out there, pointing towards me. What's playing back here, pointing behind him. The register brother says, I don't think he can hear it. So they start to sing, For the Love of You, in harmony and falsetto. When they finish their set, the brother on the register says, "Tell him that's Ron Isley." "Yes," I exclaim, "it is the Isley brothers." The sandwich brother confesses, "I know, I know. I wanted to see if he could tell the difference, because you got to admit, on some of those songs, Al Green sounds a lot like Ron Isley." Here I insert a caesura while I ponder this cogent point. "You know," I say, "you've got a point. I never thought about it before, but it's true. If you listened to Ron Isley and didn't know the song, one might mistake him for Al Green." At this moment, I laugh with these brothers louder than I've laughed since my father's death. I'm their last customer, so the brother comes from behind the register to let me out and lock the door. I get outside and walk to my car and get on with what's left of my life as wind tears at the earth, leaves settle around the streets, and daylight subdues again, till one day through a near-closed window of my mind, I'll see these two young men among the generation I once thought only sampled R&B. I'll hear the vibrato in their voices, and the mind's dust will wipe away. With their song, the sharp prongs of moonlight will catch me smiling. A silly look of hope, really, an equation of time and memory breaking through at least two generations of my blood. Thank you very much.